Proceed to the next case for argument, the United States v. Jones. Mr. Donovan?
Thank you. May it please the court and may it please opposing counsel. I'm attorney Chris Donovan. I'm here to represent Mr. Stephen Jones on this appeal. The district court in this case committed procedural error when imposing sentence upon Mr. Jones. And the main error that we raise is that the district court failed to properly consider and apply the sentencing factors contained in 18 U.S.C. Section 3553 sub A. After reviewing the sentencing transcript numerous times in this case, I can identify only three factors discussed by the court that are possibly related to the 3553A factors, and I want to discuss each of them briefly and explain why they weren't appropriately considered. First, the court did discuss Mr. Jones' attempts at cooperation. It mentioned that only the government knows completely and fully what cooperation means, that it has to be 100%, and that it has to rely upon the representations of the attorneys in this regard. Notably, however, there's no discussion of why the court credited the government's assessment over the defense attorney, because the defense attorney did provide the court information that Mr. Jones helped secure a federal indictment against his source of supply in St. Louis, and also helped provide cooperation that resulted in perhaps six or seven other convictions. Perhaps even more importantly, though, there's no discussion of how this assessment, whatever it was by the court, impacted the sentence it chose to impose on Mr. Jones. So while cooperation was mentioned, it was not meaningfully analyzed by the court, and it didn't really apply or explain how that factor impacted the sentence it chose for Mr. Jones. And that's it. Before imposing sentence, no other 3553A factor was mentioned. For example, there was no discussion of the offense itself. There was no discussion of Mr. Jones's background, personal character traits, no discussion of the need to protect the public, the need for deterrence, or the need to provide for adequate punishment. After imposing the sentence, after imposing the 262 months, and this is about four pages of transcript later, the court does discuss Mr. Jones's record. But I believe that it's clear from reading the transcript that in this context, it was in the matter of offhanded comments. The court mentioned that Mr. Jones has quite a record and quote, a lot of baggage. This was made in the context of the court wishing Mr. Jones luck in prison, wishing him the best, and encouraging him not to just rot away once he gets there. So just as the discussion for the cooperation, this really was no meaningful analysis by the court for this factor, and it didn't explain how its assessment of Mr. Jones's record impacted the sentence it chose for him. The only other arguable 3553A factor mentioned is Mr. Jones's rehabilitative needs. The court did encourage him to take advantage of opportunities offered to him in prison, but the Supreme Court in Tapia, this is cited in my reply brief, prohibits sentencing courts from imposing or lengthening a sentence to promote an offender's rehabilitation. So this factor also cannot explain or impact Mr. Jones's sentence. So it's within this context, within this backdrop of not discussing the 3553A factors, that the court then imposes a sentence at the bottom of the guideline range.
You're overlooking one of the factors, and that's the sentencing guidelines. Isn't that one of the 3553A factors?
That's correct. The guidelines are one of the factors, but again, the judge doesn't meaningfully discuss really the guideline range or why it impacts ultimate sentence it chooses to impose. For example, it doesn't explain why the sentence at the bottom of the guidelines is sufficient but not greater than necessary to achieve the objectives of Section 3553A.
Does he have to say it in that way? Does he have to use...
No, I don't think there's any magic words. I think this Court's been clear that, no, he doesn't. But, again, it's in the context of not really discussing any of the 3553A factors or meaningfully applying them or describing why they impacted the sentence it ultimately chose that I think we're left with the only explanation is that it presumed a guideline range sentence was reasonable. So I think that these two procedural errors are kind of linked. I think the primary error is not adequately explaining and analyzing the 3553 factors, but I think that kind of links into all of a sudden then we have the court imposing a sentence at the bottom of the range.
Aren't you also making the argument that Judge Mills made a presumption that the guideline sentence was correct, was reasonable?
That's correct. Again, I think that kind of links into, because he didn't adequately explain the sentence.
That argument has been made with several other of Judge Mills' recent sentencing, I believe.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I think when reviewing the totality of the transcript in this case, that remand is required so that Mr. Jones and the public at large can be assured that he was sentenced within the guidelines laid out by both this court and the Supreme Court. I do want to address briefly the government's argument that plain error should apply as a standard of review instead of de novo. I did respond to this in my reply brief. I don't want to reiterate those arguments, but the government did additionally file a 28J letter this past Friday citing several out-of-circuit cases that argue plain error review should apply. I don't believe that these cases are persuasive for several reasons. The primary one is all of the cases cited by the government except for the Girard case, and the Girard case is the case that collects all the other cases in a footnote. But other than Girard, all the cases are pre-Rita and pre-Gall. And I think that this is important because Rita and Gall, clearly direct district courts to adequately explain the chosen sentence to allow for meaningful appellate review and to promote the perception of fair sentencing. Also, it instructs courts to set forth enough to satisfy the appellate court that it has a reasoned basis for exercising its own legal decision-making authority. And I think that because these cases cited by the government were all largely decided before those two Supreme Court cases, it doesn't adequately account for the directions given by the Supreme Court. I also think that it ignores the practical reality of how defendants approach sentencings. I can speak from experience that very much the focus in a federal sentencing, from both the defendant's perspective and also the defense attorney's perspective, is what the eventual number that the judge is going to impose is, whether it's months or years, and often we're talking years, or in this case even decades. So to expect defendants to absorb the impact of the sentence imposed, immediately recognize that the court perhaps made a procedural sentencing error, and then to lodge an objection to the judge who just imposed that sentence, I believe is just not realistic and not practical. So I urge the court not to decide this case on plain error. I think, again, under the court's precedent, de novo is clearly the proper standard of review. And again, I addressed this in my reply brief, and I wanted to touch on it briefly here today. If there's no questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Ms. Mullen.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. We are here today to talk about the procedural soundness of this sentence, but I would like to pause and discuss the standard of review first. It is true that this court has found that a defendant need not take exception to a sentence once it is imposed, if indeed the defendant's argument is that the sentence is too long. That, of course, is not what we're talking about here. This is an issue of method. This is an issue about whether or not the district court judge did what he was supposed to do before imposing sentence. And it's our view and the view of the majority of circuits across the country that when we're talking about method and not substance, not the ultimate length of the sentence, it makes consummate sense to require a contemporaneous objection. And that's because by doing so, we will avoid just this situation. We will be able to avoid these types of appeals where the only argument that is presented is that the district court failed to discuss something.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is where at what point would the defense lawyer do that? The judge goes through the process and makes a statement of whatever length the judge feels is appropriate and then pronounces the sentence. Does the defense lawyer then say, well, now, wait a minute, Judge, your discussion of the 3553A factors has been insufficient?
Well, Judge Tinder, you raise a good point. Of course, we've all been in that situation where it can be a little bit awkward to interrupt a district court judge or to ask for clarification. In this particular case, however, Judge Mills twice turned to defense counsel after imposing sentence and said, did I miss anything? That would have been the perfect opportunity, did it twice on this record, to say, well, actually, Your Honor, we would have liked a more fulsome explanation about why you're not considering the defendant's age in terms of the ultimate sentence, or we'd like a little bit more discussion about cooperation. We're not really understanding your analysis with respect to that. So while it can be awkward in some situations, it is necessary, and it is necessary, again, to avoid this kind of situation, this kind of appeal. Litigants can always say, you know, excuse me, Your Honor, you know, would you please clarify this or that for the record? Some judges are more open to that kind of discussion than others. Judge Mills certainly is one of those jurists, very earnest, very much wanting to know, make sure that he has, you know, dotted all of his I's and crossed all of his T's. But moving to the actual merits of the case, we need to look at the entire sentencing record here to assess the procedural soundness of the sentence. And Judge Cudahy, you mentioned before that several of Judge Mills' sentences have been up on appeal on this issue about whether or not the judge applied a presumption of reasonableness. I would like to point out that there are three other cases that at least I'm aware of.
Yeah, I sat on one of them. Okay. So.
And in two of them, Timothy Akins and Corey Call, those cases have been resolved by this court, and this court did affirm Judge Mills' sentencing, finding no procedural error in those cases. I believe that the third one is still pending. But there's certainly no suggestion in this record that even if this court were to find a procedural infirmity in the sentence, that Judge Mills would be unable to follow any instructions by this court. The defendants in these appeals have been cross-referencing the other appeals and suggesting that we have some sort of systemic problem with Judge Mills. And not only has that not turned out to be the case, as reflected in this court's opinions, but there's certainly nothing in any of the records individually or collectively that would suggest that Judge Mills is not capable of following instruction or that he doesn't understand the necessary procedures in sentencing. So let's look to those procedures. First, we know that a judge has to properly calculate the guidelines range after resolving all of the objections. There's no argument whatsoever in this appeal that that wasn't done. This defendant is a career offender. That range was properly calculated. The judge then imposed a sentence within that range after giving both attorneys the opportunity to allocute, after giving the defendant the opportunity to directly address the court. The arguments from defense counsel and from the defendant both focused on the defendant's cooperation and what that cooperation ought to be worth in terms of the sentencing. The prosecutor also discussed the defendant's cooperation at length and explained to the court that while the defendant did start to cooperate at the beginning of the case, at some point decided not to cooperate, and by the time of sentencing had contradicted himself to such an extent that his credibility was in question and he was no longer of any use to the government. Now, what Judge Mills said to the defendant was, I believe that cooperation needs to be 100%. That is my personal belief. I give credit when I believe that a defendant has gone the distance with cooperation. So that does explain what Judge Mills was thinking with respect to the cooperation in this case. It's appropriate for a judge to turn to a prosecutor and ask for the prosecutor's assessment of the value of the cooperation. The prosecutor is in the best position to assess the value of that cooperation and communicate that information to the court. But the court also here did discuss, made sure that the parties knew that the court had thoroughly analyzed and read the PSR, a very lengthy, thorough PSR, and had considered the PSR. And the PSR, of course, goes on at some length about the prior convictions of this defendant, the very troubling prior convictions involving sexual violence against children, repeated sexual violence against children. And the court did note the criminal history in terms of imposing this particular sentence. So we have a procedurally sound sentence where the guidelines were properly calculated, the parties were given an opportunity to present their arguments, the judge explained his sentence in the context of this record. So on this record, we would ask that this court affirm Judge Mills. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Mr. Donovan?
Thank you. Just a few brief points I'd like to discuss. I don't believe that the attorney was required to object to the sentence after it was imposed. Again, the court's precedent is clear that exceptions aren't needed or required. And, again, these are out-of-circuit cases that the government's citing, so I don't think the attorney should be expected to raise an objection after the court has already made its judicial choice when it's just simply not required in this circuit. I also take exception to the government's description of the analysis of the cooperation. This wasn't a 5K1 or a 3553E motion where it was brought by the government and the judge has to rely heavily on the government's assessment and evaluation of the cooperation. This goes again to a 3553A factor. The judge could consider the cooperation whether there is a formal motion or not. And what the judge here did was basically abdicate its analysis of that cooperation to the government and didn't do his own analysis and didn't explain why he credits what the government was asserting, which is that he wasn't helpful, he wasn't useful, he ruined his credibility, versus what the defense attorney said, which is that he helped secure a federal indictment and six or seven other convictions. So we don't have, again, a meaningful analysis here of this factor and how it affected the sentence really one way or the other. And I also take exception to the government statement that, well, the judge said he read the PSR, it was an ably presented PSR. I think that this court's been clear that rote statements made by judges that they have read a PSR, that they have considered the 3553A factors without actually engaging in the analysis of those factors is enough. And I think that's, again, the main error here on appeal is that this judge did not discuss how any of the 3553A factors impacted the sentence chosen. Yes, it did mention them, but it did not actually apply them and describe why it led to the sentence it chose.
Didn't Mr. Jones acknowledge that he fell short of complete cooperation, Mr. Donovan?
Yes, he did.
Well, that was, judge obviously took that into consideration, did he not?
Right, and obviously the judge can decide whether he does credit the government or the defense more, but in this case he doesn't explain which ones he credits more. I think we can implicitly... assume
he went, that it's less than 100%, right?
Right. I mean, we can implicitly assume he went with the government on this, but he doesn't discuss what cooperation was, in fact, provided as asserted by defense counsel. And he said that I have to rely on the representations of both attorneys. So presumably he was also relying on the defense counsel. He doesn't explain what that credit may have been worth or how it affected the sentence.
Defense counsel explain away the backpedaling?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, then what is the judge to do if confronted with the government's position?
Well, he didn't explain away the backpedaling, but he did, again, offer this these facts that he did provide help in securing a conviction and a federal indictment. So I think that, again, is a 3553 factor that impacts on other things, credibility, rehabilitation, attempts at, remorse. And so I think it was something he had to explain more how it impacted the sentence. I see. I think I'm almost out of time. Does the panel have any questions?
I guess not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Donovan, an additional thanks to you for accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner.
Thank you.